what have been the big learnings along the way? I mean, would you say that the market is mature now? Is this a mature technology? Is this a mature investment class? Are we there yet? And along the way, what do we have to do to get there?
Is it mature? In some ways, it's mature in that I think it's fully investable. You've got technologies that are available, that are reliable, that mean that you can put them in the ground. The business model is visible, clear, likely to keep developing favorably. So I think that makes it very, very investable and therefore sufficiently mature as a sector to grow. In terms of maturity from a where will we end up versus where we are now, I think we'll look at our earlier plants and, you know, in 5 or 10 years' time, go, well, they still work, they're still generating good returns, but isn't it funny how we used to do things that way or that way, you know?
Hello, everybody. Welcome back for another installment of Transmission. Today, we are revisiting an episode from April 2022 with Ben Guest, Managing Director and Lead Fund Manager at Gresham House New Energy. Over the course of the conversation, Ben shares his insights into the outlooks for investments in the storage space. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe and give us a rating. It really helps us to reach a wider audience. And with that, let's jump in.
So here we are. I'm here with Ben. Ben Guest. We're in Gresham House's headquarters, your new headquarters, actually. Mm-hmm. You've been here for a year or so, isn't that?
Not even, about 6 months.
And we are here. Thanks for coming on, because I know your time is very, lots of people want it. And we are so pleased to have you on the podcast to talk about everything through the batteries and Gresham House's journey and what next, really. How is Ben Guest here as the energy storage fund guy? What happened before this? And yeah, who are you?
Okay. Just giving you a full background so that people know, I've been in the fund management industry since 1994, graduated as an engineer, and then joined Lazard Asset Management. At the time, it was called Lazard Investors, and it's a well-known fund manager in the city, actually overall merchant bank, as it was called in those days, less well-used term these days. And I became a junior fund manager and junior analyst, focusing on all sorts of different areas, but levered early on my knowledge of technology, being a recently graduated engineer and someone who studied electronics at A-level and various other things.
Yeah, back in the analog days.
Back early days of digital.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not that old.
I was just throwing one out there, seeing whether you'd catch it. Yeah.
Early days of digital, early days of fiber, early days of relatively early days of semiconductors and sort of microprocessors and so on. And dare I say, mobile phones and other things as well. Emails were a new thing when I was working. So I started there and I learnt my trade in fund management and in what was in those days and even today, I think, known as a value investing outfit, and learned an awful lot about that. I focused on areas like TMT, Tech Media Telecom, as they became relevant areas towards the end of the 90s and early noughties. Then tried my hand at hedge fund management and did that within Lazard and then within another company that emerged from people who came from Lazard in 2003 and did that for 3 or 4 years.
So you ran your own fund?
Absolutely. Hedge fund. Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So I ran Europe's largest long-short tech fund.
Wow. Okay.
It was $1 billion at its peak. And then decided to wind all that up and pack it all in and set up my own business called Hazel Capital.
For a low-stress life instead.
For a low-stress life. Yeah. Just before the financial crisis hit as well in 2008, which was very low stress. And found my way and decided to make it an entirely green, if I can use the expression green or clean tech, popular expression in the day, focused company.
Okay.
So sort of left all the knowledge I had behind, other than obviously being able to use it in other ways within the new area. And then quickly realized that the most interesting area from an investability perspective and scalability perspective was infrastructure. It wasn't about the manufacturers. It wasn't about other parts of the value chain. I was most interested in the infrastructure side, and then eventually backfilled, if you want to call it that, in the development side. So initially thought, well, you know, fund managers, equity fund managers, whether long, short or otherwise, think it's a good year if they've made anywhere, depending on their risk profile, 5 to 20%. And I was thinking, you can buy a solar farm, especially in this environment, in Southern Europe, because the UK didn't have any yet.
No sunshine.
But in 2000, no sunshine yet. In 2008 or 9, you could actually sort of buy solar farms with 20% IRRs. And I was thinking, wow, you buy it, you look after it, but you don't have to sort of go and pick stocks every year, many, many times over, and make sure you get that right and manage your risk. It's there and it's there forever. And I was very interested in that. And it was actually new to me as an investment area, and learned the trade by trying and by doing, and learned all about the underlying technologies and the O&M and the challenges from a legal perspective and due diligence and everything else. And basically, you know, cut my teeth buying initially a distressed solar farm in Spain, and then went from there. And then when the market emerged in 2010 for feed-in tariff subsidized solar projects, we got heavily involved. We went for it and raised a couple of VCTs.
This is all Hazel Capital.
This is all Hazel Capital, and you know, built four of the first circa sort of 5 megawatt solar projects under the initial feed-in tariff regime, which came to an abrupt end because of the realization that the UK might be making a similar mistake to what the Spanish made in terms of allowing too many megawatts getting built under a very generous subsidy scheme. So that was cut short, but so there was a hiatus immediately after that. I don't know if you remember that. But we went from there and developed and or managed about 300 megawatts in the first few years of Hazel Capital. And then when the subsidies came to an end, and at the similar time, the ability to invest through tax efficient schemes into renewables also came to an end. We started to pivot into new areas and looked at very many areas. But one of the areas that really took hold in around 2015 was the batteries. So mm-hmm. As long ago as 2015, built initial projects with contracts in FFR. So commercial FFR, as opposed to EFR, where we just saw everyone heading at that market and being overly basically competitive in the auction. So if you win at an auction, my rule of thumb is you've actually lost, not won. So it's probably not a fair comparison every time, but it's an indicator that you've obviously paid the most.
Well, yeah, we saw projects, I think EDF went down to £7 for their budget, and we had FFR prices at like 15, 20 quid.
In those days, FFR prices were in the 20s. And our lowest price was, I think, about 18. I forget the exact.
It's like everybody do the EFR thing, and the play was don't go there, look over here.
Yeah. Now, of course, EFR was 4 years.
Of course.
FFR was for two. It's still generous in those days for new projects. And we built our first 70 megawatts, and that became the seed portfolio for the Gresham House Energy Storage Fund. And of course, while we're building those, I was having lots of conversations with Gresham House and coming inside to really sort of continue the story in energy storage and go from there.
Okay, so if I got this right, originally an engineer, were you a chemical engineer?
No,
were you mechanical but also did lots of electronics stuff as well.
Yeah.
Then moved into investing, hedge fund manager for a while, that would have been crazy.
Yeah.
And then left all that behind and started a brand new thing, getting into solar at Hazel Capital, moved really, really fast, and then got into batteries.
Correct.
Pretty much 2015, which was early back then, looking at
far. Yeah.
Okay. And so you've been doing this for a long time, and you've been doing batteries for a long time. I want to talk about batteries specifically. Mm. And this is it's almost a silly question because it's so big, but what have been the big learnings along the way? I mean, would you say that the market is mature now? Is this a mature technology? Is this a mature investment class? Are we there yet? And along the way, what do we have to do to get there?
Is it mature? In some ways it's mature, in that I think it's fully investable. You've got technologies that are available, that are reliable, that mean that you can put them in the ground. The business model is visible, clear, likely to keep developing favorably. So I think that makes it very, very investable and therefore sufficiently mature as a sector to grow. In terms of maturity from where will we end up versus where we are now, I think we'll look at our earlier plants and, you know, in 5 or 10 years time and go, well, they still work, they're still generating good returns, but isn't it funny how we used to do things that way or that way? You know, the easy examples are the fact that our first batteries weren't containerized by the manufacturer of those battery cells. It was done by the EPC contractor. So they did a very good job, but you know, they are very much shipping containers that have been containerized, in which the batteries have been containerized. Well, now everything is, you know, made for purpose, and that's extracting cost, and I think there'll be a cost curve, especially on the system side, that will be pretty significant. And so there'll be standardization, more standardization. But other areas where there's maturity, you know, when we first got involved, the company, we were, one of the partners we were working with, actually wrote the control system, developed the APIs for the interfaces with the batteries for the first time. All of these are now, you know, readily provided by the optimizers and or other companies that specifically provide what you could call the glue whenever you've got a missing piece. And examples of that would be the funds that we've subsequently raised were used to acquire some EFR projects. Those EFR projects were also the early projects commissioned in 2018. So some of those have got relatively rudimentary control systems, you know, layering on software onto that provided by third parties. You know, that just speaks to the maturity, the fact that that's even possible. Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely moved
interfaces on interfaces there.
It is interfaces on interfaces. So it's not, it works well. It's just more counterparties you have to deal with. Yeah.
And what about the narrow, actually let's put some numbers around it, right? Because some of the folks listening, I'd imagine Gresham House doesn't really need much introduction, but let's do it anyway. So sure. How big is the portfolio now? How big are we talking?
Sure. So the portfolio is 425 megawatts of operational assets. We've got 415 megawatts of assets in construction. We've got a portfolio that we've announced, which if you include the operational portfolio, the in-construction portfolio, and the remainder of the pipeline, it totals 1.557 megawatts.
Wow.
The gigawatts, sorry.
So you've got as much as you got built now, you've got under construction already. So
pretty much.
Things, you know, going in the ground.
Yep.
And then on top of that, you've got another sort of 60-70% as well. On top, my math isn't great.
Yep.
But
about almost the same again. So
what's the end game? How big does Gresham House go with this?
That's a really good question. I mean, it depends what time horizon you take. Is there ever an end point for a company? Probably not. You know, mm-hmm. It's a continuum. But if you were to sort of...
Actually, if you asked me the question about Modo, yeah. I'd probably just
clear
freak
record.
Out. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I don't know. There is no end, right? Yeah, you're right.
Exactly. What's sort of really clear is, and if you sort of take a global perspective or a very macro perspective, you realize that the energy market is colossal, which is why I got into this. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of just to give you another little bit of background. You know, when I was in TMT and in tech in particular, my expertise was in understanding cost curves and in the development of industries and just how quickly they developed. You know, it sort of take decades for TVs to penetrate the entire population. It took a decade for mobile phones to penetrate the global population, pretty much. So just how different it was. And then I thought, well, where is the next big S-curve from a career perspective that I can also add value in? And what do I also care about, which is sort of the green agenda. And I was just amazed by how big the energy market is compared to the tech sector, for example. And if you think that the entire energy market is historically subdivided into oil consumption, gas consumption, electricity consumption, and all of that is now going to become electricity, and all of that is generated by renewables, and then it dawns on you that you need batteries sitting alongside all of those renewables, you realize that while the renewable sector is absolutely colossal, or will be, it's very big already, but it will be absolutely colossal. The same goes for energy storage. And then you realize just how big a thing we have embarked on. And I was running some numbers the other day. You know, in the US, the penetration of renewables is really under 20% if you think of wind and solar. And that will obviously go to 100%. But then you're talking about overall electricity consumption probably going up three times.
Yeah, it makes my brain hurt. I mean, electrification of everything. Mm-hmm. And then I believe, I know this is, some people don't agree with this, but energy consumption is a key driver of general opportunity and bringing up, you know, the whole world to a standard of living that is necessary. I don't think we can do it without increasing in consumption. So you've got those two things, electrification of everything plus mm-hmm. that, and you've got a market which is most people would kill to be involved in.
Well, they're welcome to join.
Yeah. But I guess the also part of the story is, so you guys have got a gigawatt, 2 gigawatts in a couple of years, you know, that's the kind of numbers we're talking about.
Mm.
But that might end up being a drop in the ocean in 15, 20 years' time.
Yes.
So maybe you have to go even faster and even bigger. I don't know.
I don't know about faster. Certainly we're growing fast enough. We're very busy. But bigger, for sure. I mean, it's my view that being gigawatt scale will not make you a large player. In the electricity market longer term. It'll be multi-gigawatt, maybe deca-gigawatt, you know, sort of that will be a player that is, you know, significant. Because if we can be a gigawatt plus in the UK, which represents about 1% of the global electricity market. It gives you an idea of just how big the global electricity market is. Yeah. You know, and so it just happens to be that the UK has been forward thinking for a bunch of reasons, you know, Ofgem, BEIS, National Grid, the investor set, everybody, it's all, events have come together to result in an early emerging battery sector.
I've got to ask you, so you're the fund manager, right? You're the, so part, excuse my ignorance, but yeah. Part of your job as a fund manager is fundraising, right? And so mm-hmm. if you've been doing this for a fairly long time, you would have seen how the narrative or the story has changed over time with raising capital and getting investors comfortable with these kind of assets. Mm-hmm. So I wonder whether you just comment on that. You know, where are we now and how far have we come? And are investors now comfortable with this thing that seems so normal to us now because we're in it every day? But there's lots of folks out there who still, they hear about it for the first time and it sounds like space age stuff. How does that work and what are you seeing?
It's a really good question. First of all, our narrative in terms of what we tell investors has not changed. You know, we've consistently talked to the thesis that this is all about the intermittency of renewables, that batteries enable a cost-effective transition by avoiding curtailment and the need to fill in troughs in supply with gas or something else. And therefore, it makes it cost-effective from a CO2 budget perspective and a cost perspective. Genuinely, mm-hmm. you're saving electricity. And that has been the mainstay for what we say. That is the reason you build these batteries. Everything else is ancillary, literally, and a nice business to be in if you can make money out of it and, you know, use your batteries more gently as we have over the last few years. But that is our core thesis. We, of course, there are lots of investors who are still becoming familiar with this and still have elementary questions, which are completely fair around, you know, is there a risk of obsolescence? What's the risk around competition? Are you going to arbitrage your returns away? And the answer to that is yes, but it's going to take about 3 decades and you know, not to zero. And other questions around just what is the business model, what is trading, you know, how does it work, how are power prices set? In some cases, it's difficult to know what questions to ask if you don't know the electricity market, yes. because it's so yeah. familiar to us. But it's not an industry which lends itself to outside-in learning, because we almost have to know where to look. It's very hard to find decent primers and so on. It's getting probably better. National Grid's getting increasingly transparent with useful web pages and the like, and you can learn from others as well. But it is a relatively challenging industry to get to know. And if you don't understand the principles of electricity on top of that, or also the wholesale market mechanism, or how the networks are set up, it's probably a challenge if you come from a background of something tangential, whether it's infrastructure or something else, that you probably have a head start. But yeah, it's definitely challenging in that sense for our investor or prospective investor base. But, you know, one of the key messages we share is that, especially one of the things that really challenged investors is the fact that it's a merchant business model. So the fact that we don't fully contract our revenues in a space where fully contracted revenues are attractive, and you can contract them, as you know, you can certainly in terms of floor prices, but we don't see the value in that, and our investors haven't expected that of us at this stage. And
that's interesting.
Yeah, and equally interestingly, is nor have our lenders. So right. We secured debt last year, and I had prior to that thought, well, maybe we have to start contracting some of our revenues in order to secure debt at attractive levels in terms of total quantum, but also cost of money. And that hasn't been the case. They've been comfortable with a sufficiently low and the levels we wanted, you know, 25-30% leverage, which increases returns, but we're securing, you know, 3-3.5% money. That is exciting because it means that the industry's moved on.
That is so contrary to, I think, conventional thinking around this, which is that the reason why you have a floor price is because institutional investors and debt need floor prices, because otherwise they can't get comfortable because this thing's so new and blah, blah. Right. And so what you're saying is that's not the case. Maybe that's because it's Gresham House, right? Maybe that's...
I think there's a case for that. Our debt facility is what's called a CapEx facility. So we draw it down as new investments come through. Mm-hmm. It's not leveraging the existing portfolio. But the existing portfolio there has a strong cash flow, which can service the debt as it comes through. So it provides an extra protection for the lender. If you look at the rates that we're talking about, they're certainly at a premium to what solar and wind projects get debt at. But given the higher returns, the servicing of that debt is largely covered by CM contracts, for example. And so there's really strong coverage and security there. So it's worked out very well that there is good coverage at sensible levels of debt that haven't spooked investors. And the idea that we have a portfolio has obviously helped. Yeah.
Could I ask you on that? Because so I would have thought that a floor price would be really attractive to you, Ben Guest at Gresham House. And it sounds like from you speaking, it's not. Or the way that they're currently offered isn't. Is that because you have to pay a premium for them or because the numbers are too low and you are far more bullish on energy storage, as I am, than many of the floor prices offer? How are you thinking about it?
Yeah, ultimately, it's what do you put in your financial model if you have a floor price contract and what do you put in your model if you've got a merchant contract? And they're very different numbers. So I'll go with the merchant contract, thanks very much. And it is the confidence in understanding the market. And that goes to one of the key messages we share with our shareholders, which is this is a fundamentally profitable business model. So when you use the word trading to people in the finance industry, they might think, you know, short-term trading, derivatives, speculation, potential for loss on a daily basis. It's not that. It's not any of that. You are dealing with a positive spread that exists as a function of supply-demand imbalances that nothing else can store
or capture.
And so we capture those spreads. Our investors and lenders have all understood that. And therefore, it's about a positive return and where that positive return lands. That's the uncertainty. But that's not such a bad thing. At least our investors have got comfortable that it's not such a bad thing to have that variability, given that the starting point is substantially positive. And so if you're looking at a starting return where, you know, even the lower end of a likely outcome is probably better than you get on a renewables project, you know, it's not a bad investment.
Yeah.
Surely, question mark.
It's like if you're an investor and you're going to invest in Gresham House or a fund or, you know, you're going to buy battery assets or a bit of one, you've got to wrap your head around the whole macro picture anyway. So you're going to have to get comfortable with how merchant works and exactly as you say.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go to all the trouble of figuring out how that works and you're in the asset class because you understand its need and all the stuff that we've been talking about, then why give away a bit of that to a floor price just to another counterparty who sort of agrees with you, but not quite as much?
Absolutely. You just read my mind. Absolutely. Yeah. Exactly that. Yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about Optimizer for a second because Gresham House, of course, you've got 425 megawatts now. You're going to have a lot more megawatts. Mm-hmm. And I think all of these assets are out at the moment, or most of them are with Optimizers. Mm-hmm. And of course, that will happen. You just signed a big deal with Orenco. Congratulations on that. Mm-hmm. How do you think about Optimized in this space? And you've used a lot of different ones, right? Some of which I've been on the end of in previous lives. How do you think about how Optimizers have come on in the last few years and what are you excited about to do with Optimizers and how do you choose one?
Well, that just sort of going full circle, that's another area where maturity has sort of emerged. You know, when we first got involved, we were sort of interrogating, if that's the right word, or interviewing the Optimizers and ensuring
they were tough interviews, by the way, on the other side of the table.
Oh, I see.
Go back a slide. What does that chart mean? Exactly what does that chart mean?
Well, we really wanted to understand how our optimizers made money because, you know, that's one of the big challenges with batteries is how does a battery get entered into the market, whether it's the BM balancing mechanism or wholesale market, and make money given that it's got to choose when it charges, which in effect means when it makes itself available in due course for export. And and that's so different to gas peakers and other dispatchable assets where it's just basically around the cost of the fuel. And if the power price is higher than the cost of fuel, you run it and you keep running it because there's no end of battery life. You just keep running it and you just keep it up. So those are the two big differences. It's sort of a variable short-run marginal cost for a battery and it's a function of its import cost and the fact that you can only run it for a finite amount of time. Those are the two fundamental differences. We make the equation for how you run these assets completely different. So we got our heads around that, but we just wanted to see who else could do this. And fortunately, there were a handful of companies, quite extraordinarily really, emerging to do exactly that. They literally made their entire business about that. You know, Habitat Energy and Orenco being two great examples, as well as in-house optimization teams at places like EDF and Flexitricity. You know, they really understood the need to move away from, you know, human-based Excel sheet trading, you know. And unfortunately, that was there. And therefore, we could, as our FFR contracts, initial FFR contracts on our seed assets rolled off, we could actually allocate capacity to these companies, and they've been extremely impressive in how they've developed.
But what's mad is you guys have, you've been around the whole market, you've worked with most of the optimizers once, mm-hmm. I think, and you've learned all this stuff, mm-hmm. and you're still now saying, you know what, we're not going to do this in-house. So that must mean, A, you're getting a pretty good service from these optimizers, or you're comfortable now with the work that they do and that they're worth it, which actually, my personal thought is, I think the job of an optimizer has become so much more difficult. Mm. And it's been impressive how some in particular have really stepped up on, and not just performance, but also on reporting and all the other stuff that they have to do. But what's cool is you guys have been around the whole market. You must have considered we can do this in-house. We could build this in-house. And you're still saying, you know what? We're going to give this stuff to other people. Yeah. So how do you make that decision?
Well, if you think about what makes up an optimizer, it's not what we have in-house. It's software engineers. It's people who understand the market and trading, you know, as well as they breathe, you know, it's really, really well. And people who can develop machine learning algorithms or other AI concepts to really make the decisions. And then they have to be able to create the IT infrastructure that can process incredible amounts of data and therefore understand the need for a highly, highly reliable and redundant IT system as well. These are skills that we just don't have in-house. We could absolutely bring them in-house and do that. But as you get bigger, you get better terms on an optimization agreement and you get that as a function of your scale. You don't need to go through the challenge of doing that yourself and making mistakes and or getting it right, but there's that risk.
Yeah.
And so why introduce that risk when there's a robust set of optimizers out there?
And a highly competitive market for them. It's highly pushing them against each other. You know, there's so much innovation in that space.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, even though they're all, especially the leaders, are extremely smart, there is more than one of them. So there is a degree of competition. So that's obviously we benefit from that. So, you know, if you think about what we want to achieve, it's achieving scale and returns for our shareholders. Returns for our shareholders, and there's a function of scale, and there's a function of good fund management, which is a function of good capital discipline, good, in equity market terms, stock selection, selecting the right projects, designing them well, contracting well, negotiating well. And that's our core skill set. And doing that more than trying our hand at optimization when it's not necessary. It's just not necessary. And when you achieve scale through a simple focus strategy, that's how you come out with the decisions where you don't do anything.
I'm just thinking as an infrastructure play like this game that you guys are in. I guess there's the idea in the financial world that past performance doesn't indicate future performance, or whatever that word is, that mm-hmm. phrase that comes over on the radio and on the news whenever this happens, right? But I guess if you're an asset business, it kind of does, right? It has to, because you've learned, because every time you build an asset, every time you run an asset, every moment that you're running an asset, you're learning. And it's about your learn rate. In the startup parlance, it's a learn rate thing, which I'm sure you're... It's just a funny one to think about, which is, you know, although I guess all of that would be priced in. I'm just going around in my head. How does that sit? Anyway, I'm going down a rabbit hole in my own mind here.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, consistency of performance speaks to investment process, and also then... Given that each of these projects is sort of operating business, the sustainability or the operating environment will determine whether, you know, their own returns slip or commoditize or whatever. But I'm very much taking the view that we need to be, you know, in inverted commas, paranoid, you know, assume that we might enter another COVID environment where electricity demand collapses and gas prices are, you know, sort of setting prices in the 20s. And we want to be, this is my own personal goal, is to be able to hit our dividend even in that horrible environment. And we're confident we're going to get there. That means that, because having been a student of markets and companies and industries for so long, you realize that all industries eventually commoditize.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that the leading company in that industry can't make good returns. We want to be that company.
You just got to win.
You got to be that company.
Well, that brings us on to consolidation. What are you thinking about consolidation in this market? Mm. Because at the moment, it's wild how many new entrants there are, assets, you know, there's talk of you know, various new funds. They've got three big funds now. There's talk of new ones this year. Mm-hmm. We've got utilities buying assets, oil companies getting involved in assets. There's so much, you know, real estate funds, property funds, supermarket funds. There's all sorts of folks in this place now. So what happens in the next? Will there be consolidation, or is there enough space for everybody?
I think we've been through one phase of consolidation, which is the sale by most of the EFR assets. And we bought 120 of, I think, the 200 meg that got awarded contracts in 2016 and got built in 2018. So that was one phase of consolidation where we bought assets from those exiting the sector, and then one other asset as well from a player exiting the sector. So that is a first wave, I think, of people entering the market and going, yeah, not for us, or whatever they decided. There's bound to be a second wave and or third wave, and to the extent that they're waves or whether it becomes continuous, you know, you sort of have people who build assets, choose to run them for a bit, whether they think they're going to get a better return as a result of doing something like that, and then sell them or just pivot into something else. Whatever the reasons are, there's bound to be consolidation. But I at the moment, as you say, there's, I'm not sure the right word is fragmentation, but there's certainly a lot of new entrants and a lot of, yeah, sort of new players, and we'll see how they all get on.
It's kind of comforting because it means there's loads of new players who are saying, this is the place to put my money. But then it's kind of uncomfortable too, because then you can turn that on its head and say, if there's so much interest, then I'm glad I'm first or I'm big or whatever. But that also makes me feel uncomfortable.
Makes you feel uncomfortable?
Well, I mean, I don't own assets. Yeah. I don't own my house, and that does well for me, but that's about it. But yeah, it doesn't make me feel uncomfortable. But with so much, if you have growth of interest in the sector forever, to a point, there's too much growth of interest in the sector, sure. I guess. I don't think we're there yet. It's just something that I was also thinking of.
No, I think we're far from that.
And then I just got a couple more questions. A bit of a silly question, really, but have you guys looked internationally? Most of what you do is in Great Britain at the moment. I think all of it is in Great Britain.
Great Britain, and we have an initial pipeline project that we've disclosed in Ireland.
Okay.
180 meg project.
I don't want you to say anything you haven't disclosed, or I'm sure you guys are looking around the world. So what are you thinking about international markets? Is that something that is important to Gresham House right now?
It's something we're always exploring. One of the great things about this sector is electricity is the same wherever you go. If you put in a battery system, you're going to put in a similar battery system wherever you go. The analysis is different in terms of what the market is. But ultimately, even the generation mix will be a version of what you have in the UK. You know, it'll be renewables, gas, maybe coal, maybe nuclear, maybe hydro, but in the different mixes and with, crucially, different weather patterns. But all that does is alter the equation and the output in terms of what you might build. But ultimately, you're still going to build a battery system with probably the same technology. That does mean that the industry's sort of, well, our skills or our knowledge could be exported abroad, but we haven't made any commitments abroad beyond Ireland.
What strikes me is, and we're looking internationally in various different markets, and we'll be in various different markets soon. That's all very exciting, but it's kind of, you learn the Great British market, and you learn about frequency response and, you know, fast response and the balancing mechanism, and you think, oh, I've got to go and learn all these other markets again. But they're very similar. It's a bit like learning French when you speak English, or, you know, there's so much crossover. Actually, I don't speak great French.
That's a good example.
You should do this in French. I thought you were going to, oh no, I think they'll start talking to me in French.
I could do that.
That's a really bad example. What my point is, that you may have a different type of auction structure or different rules or different settlement period thing, but actually the general principles are the same. Whether you're looking here, you know, you need frequency response, you need a deep merchant market, you need a deep balancing market eventually, you need access to these markets, and everything's moving towards real time. As long as you kind of get your head around that, the new markets aren't that complicated. That's what I've thought, but maybe that's my arrogance coming through here.
I don't think it's arrogance. I think it's a good summary. Of course, there's devil in detail. You know, not every market is a wholesale market structure, so that sort of displays certain markets. And of course, there could be complexities at all the levels, whether it's at the development stage, interconnection, sort of before, you know, the pre-commissioning stage. And there are complexities in those areas. But again, they are all just shades of grey. The way I observe it for the time being is that every market has the same requirements. So you still have to worry about, you know, whether it's called a construction license or planning permission or something else, or interconnection or enduring connection or just a connection offer. It doesn't, it's just parlance and jargon, but different regulations, laws, rules seem to be emphasized and applied differently depending on the country, but more as a function of history. But ultimately, those rules all exist and exist for a good reason.
I want to ask you one last question, and I'm going to come back to this end game point, right? What's the vision? So where does energy storage, you're deep in energy storage now, right? Where does energy storage fit in the future energy system?
Yeah.
You know, how important is it? How much stuff is it doing? And what's the impact that it has on humanity? Bit of a big question, but...
Big question. Rather than taking the global view this time, I'll take the UK view.
Yeah.
We have best estimate off the top of my head is probably about 37 gigawatts of average demand for power through the year. Huge variability intraday and seasonally, but you know, that's the level. But electricity represents 20% or so of total energy consumption. So that 20% is going to go to 100%. It doesn't mean that we go up five times, because electric cars are more efficient than petrol cars, much more. Gas heating is much less efficient than heat pumps, which are at least twice as efficient. So we might see electricity demand double or triple, though, especially with some economic growth. And maybe we even onshore something, who knows, as opposed to having gone the other way for decades. Within that larger electricity pie, we will see renewables become 80 to 100% of the total if we want to hit net zero. And we need to do that. I think it's entirely possible based on the resource that we have, then especially offshore wind. You'll need the energy storage. And you'll need two forms of energy storage. You need energy storage as we know it, which will cover a huge percentage of situations. And you'll need what's called long duration energy storage, which might not end up being long duration energy storage. It might end up being, you know, when we have a 500 hour under generation from wind fleet event, it might just be gas with sequestered CO2. And when we've got
more interconnectors, I'm back in interconnectors, you know.
Yeah, I've always scratched my head about interconnectors. Yeah, in many situations they might help. In other situations, that they might just prove that they don't help. As in, you know, if it's super sunny and windy and blustery or something across all of Europe, everyone's wanting to export to everyone else, it doesn't really solve the problem. But, you know, that's my slightly tongue-in-cheek example, but I've been using that one for a while, all versions of it. And same goes the other way around. You know, if it's, you know, it's surprisingly still winter's evening, you know, got no solar, you've got, you know, no wind, all of Europe will be stuck with
Does it matter when you can get capacity market contracts in both ends of your interconnector?
Well, that's a commercial question. Yeah. And that speaks to,
sorry, another one out there.
Do you care about solving the problem, or do you care about making money? And I think we need to focus on achieving both.
Yeah.
No, I think you end up with the shortfalls in generation over long duration events, which doesn't really apply to what we're doing, except in certain circumstances, being achieved. Well, the only technology I know of today would be a gas engine, which is dispatchable and can be flexible from a zero set point, give or take. While when you're oversupplying, well, maybe we end up onshoring some energy intensive industries.
Never thought about this before. So instead of doing long duration energy storage, we have lots of short-ish duration energy storage. And then when we have the really sort of almost black swan-y event that we're talking about, we just run gas and make it really efficient gas.
Yeah.
We're okay with that. I've never considered that before.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm just, this goes to the core of how about these, think about these things. It's like, don't plug in a technology that doesn't exist yet, because it might never come along. And I don't know of a single technology that does solve it. Even an interseasonal battery, you know, has a self-discharge rate that makes it relatively ineffective if the oversupply event comes in the early part of the year, and then the undersupply event comes later in the year when you need it. You've already self-discharged because the battery's self-discharged. And of course, you can keep them topped up, but that effect speaks to
inefficiency. It's like evaporation. In a pump hydro.
Right. Exactly. Very good example. And I haven't thought of that.
Well, I'll use yours.
Swap. Yeah, exactly. Like, so essentially, I think those are sort of three underpinnings in the future, in whatever mix within the renewables and in whatever mix we end up seeing within the key quote-unquote storage segments, because actually one of them might just be more gas with which is decarbonized.
But it's big, right? The numbers you're talking about there are two or three times peak, absolutely two or three huge times average load now. So that's like almost tripled, almost 100 gigs of electricity and mass electrification.
Yeah.
And we're going to get there with mostly renewables. So let's say I don't know, above 50 gigawatts, but it could be 75, 80, right?
Of additional gig of nameplate capacity, I would have thought it was another 100.
Yeah. Because you there's a load factor.
Capacity factor, yeah.
And then, yeah, and then you need a load of batteries. So we're talking, we've got a long way to go. We could be doing one of these in 10 years' time and still talking. And
we could.
Figuring out what on earth were we talking about 10 years
let's,
ago?
Let's agree to
let's do that.
That.
And that's probably a good time to wrap up, Ben. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and taking time out of your day. I'm sure everybody listening absolutely loved that conversation. If you've got comments, please do let us know in the comments, or remember to subscribe on Spotify or whatever, wherever you're listening. And until next time, we'll see you soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.